Well, thank you. I come as a fellow emissary from a city which defines itself against the rest of the nation, which has trams, coffee, embraces its soccer team to sort of slightly annoy possibly the rest of the country, and state government, which describes its goal to be the most progressive state government in the entire nation. A city, which looks at our northern neighbours as much more religious and much more conservative. So we have some opening ground to sort of find similarity in. One of the weird things is that I actually find it easier, in a sense, talking in an environment like Portland than when I go to other parts of my own country. And what you're sort of finding at the moment now is that really what Portland and Melbourne are cities which are taken hold of by a kind of globalization for people who don't like globalization. Our claim to fame as a city is that Starbucks for many years saw Melbourne as one of the hardest coffee markets to crack in the world. And so they came, they had a plan, but it failed horribly. And after putting little outlets all across the city, they one day invited all of their employees to the tennis center in Melbourne, where the Australian Open Grand Slam tennis is, and sacked them all in one moment and retreated from the city. And we take great pride in that. But then bizarrely, you know, a flat white, which is a classic sort of Australian coffee, you can now get here. And then weirdly, now Starbucks have flat whites. So we as Australians are now oppressing you Americans with our cultural hegemony. Also like the word selfie, which is another Australian thing. Less proud about a selfie. One of the interesting things though is that what you find is I got up early this morning and went to this cafe, and I'm sitting in a cafe having a flat white at Stumptown Roasters. And what's interesting is that at Stumptown Roasters, you have this experience of having a flat white. You're sitting in this environment and you sit there and I look out the window of the store and the street's different. But it's a similar experience that I've now had having a flat white, being served like by a barista who looks like the barista in a similar coffee shop in Wellington, New Zealand. I have had the same experience in Copenhagen in Denmark, in a similar coffee shop in London. And so we're having this experience now that there's this particular sensibility that you're now seeing emerging around the world. What's really interesting about this sensibility is that it has a similar language. It has a similar tone. It embraces freedom. It builds itself around an idea that we, unlike people throughout most of history, have cracked how to do human socialness and human community, and that if we can just create these sort of urban oases where we live local, eat local, embrace these terms of inclusion, diversity, walk away from prejudice, that what will happen is something magical will happen, which has never really happened in history, is that we'll sort of gently slide towards a kind of progressive utopia. And that there's this sense where the same thing that you find in these cities is not just similar coffee, is not just organic lentils, is not just people riding around bicycles with little baskets on the front. But what you find too is that some of the language and self-understanding of these places also aligns itself with a view of religion. That religion, as it's understood or organized religion, that it's fading in these places. If any sort of religious belief is tolerated, it then tolerated under the rubric of we're spiritual, not religious. We're not into organized religion, which then you might like, are we into disorganized religion? What does that mean? But this sense that somehow we in cities like mine and yours are the avant-garde, the front runners of where everything will head. And that eventually what's going to happen is this is going to take off everywhere and slowly other people will become enlightened to how wonderful we really are. and how clever. And slowly, as people get more freedoms, more education, as they watch more Netflix documentaries, that the world will come a better place. What's really interesting is this myth, which seemed at its apogee, at its height, only a couple of years ago, is increasingly coming under pressure. In Australia recently, a survey was done by the Australian National University which showed that actually underneath the surface, many people were believing very different things. A survey came out of Melbourne. So in Melbourne, you've got a downtown which is filled with young people, filled with coffee shops, but the downtown is filled with young people with disposable income, is predominantly Chinese and Indian, Indonesian, Singaporean. That's actually socially conservative. And people could understand this because, hang on, isn't history going in this direction? And when you have a cool flat white in your hand and you're wearing some ironic hat, that eventually, therefore, your religious makeup is going to change and you're going to get with the program about sexual ethics and different things. But that story is not exactly adding up. Interestingly, the parts of town, our inner north, which is probably like East Portland, which is the most embracing of inclusion and diversity, where when you go in, there's often signs saying, we welcome everyone of different genders and races and religions. There's an article in the paper saying, ironically, it's in those places which you're least likely to find places, people rather, of other religions, races, and creeds. And so this bizarre dynamic is going on where the people who preach a kind of diversity, the people who preach a kind of plurality, the people who adhere to a sense of inclusion, ironically become incredibly monocultural, where dissenting views are not embraced. We have, as part of this reaction, a sense of what is happening is that there's a drowning a little bit in this freedom. I was reading the Portland Monthly magazine in my hotel room, which they put there, and it was interesting. The issue this week was, this month rather, was all about empowering women and all different influencers in the city of women, and interviewing some shop which is like a feminist t-shirt place. You may know what it is. And what's really interesting, all this stuff about how it's going to be empowering women. And then there was this interesting stat that in a state of Oregon, which sees itself as progressive and embracing of women's rights and so on, has the most nationally number one of depressed women. In my city, where we have this incredible freedom, unlike humans have really experienced before, where you can pretty much create and be who you want to be. You can move to a part of town, reinvent yourself. Every time I go and speak in Australia, New Zealand, in other cities, there's a line of people who are going to move to Melbourne who are almost always graphic designers. Or in a band. And what's really interesting, you can come to Melbourne and reinvent yourself. Yet in my city, underneath the surface, there's a mental health crisis. Young men are killing themselves in record numbers. In Scandinavia, upheld as this sort of nirvana that cities like you and mine want to aim towards, where we become Copenhagen, where everyone's on a bike, where you want to live Danishly with hygge, with minimalism and wooden stuff everywhere. That Scandinavia has a similar crisis. Tom McCarthy, in his novel Saturn Island, features a corporate ethnologist who's trying to capture this distinct cultural moment. So he's paid by this corporation to go around the world and ask, what is now? What is the contemporary? And at the beginning of the novel, McCarthy paints this image of him at Torino Casale Airport in Italy, and his flight is delayed, and he's looking at the arrivals departures board, and everything's off whack because there's one plane which is off the charts, which then affects all the other flights. And so he's watching the board, and at the same time, they've got TVs on in the airport, and on one TV, there's this football match between Barcelona and Real Madrid, and he's watching that game. Then on the other TV screen, there's like CNN, and there's this bombing in Baghdad in a marketplace somewhere in the Middle East. And he's watching these two juxtaposed images, which don't make sense. This entertainment, which is being watched all over the world, next to this incredible moment of violence and terror. He has his laptop open on his lap, where they tend to go, and he's looking at his email. He's web surfing about this particular airport, then getting into this like rabbit warren of web links about hub airports, and then he's looking at bicycle spokes and hubs on wheels. At the same time, it's not so much his girlfriend, but his friend with benefits who he's sleeping with, who McCarthy just does brilliantly. He just like has this line like, I met Madison, we had sex, full stop. And then this entering into this awkward thing where they're trying to relate, trying to be intimate emotionally. It's easier for them to have sex than to have a conversation. And she's like trying to ring him on Skype, but he can't get the full Wi-Fi, so it's like buffering. So she's talking and her face contorts in these different sort of weird expressions, and that buffering symbol, which McCarthy says is the symbol of our age, promising so much, yet we have to wait always. In his pocket, his cell begins to vibrate. He takes it out and his boss says, we got it. And he texts back, we got what? There's no context to the text. He's there, he's in the airport, but he's somehow disembodied. And his boss texts back, the contract. Working on this big contract. He looks at the soccer match and it seems like the striker who's celebrating a goal is cheering for him. He looks at the marketplace bombing and it's like the young person running towards the camera in terror looks almost like the striker, the way he's running, both with their mouth opens. And he says almost for that moment he's tricked that they're cheering for him winning this contract. He looks to his right at one of those luxury stores that they have in airports. And the images from the TV and the board then melt together on the slick high-end tile work of the store and the glass in the store window, and everything melts together. And what McCarthy captures so brilliantly is this concept of life without boundaries, where everything's melting together, where you are going to a party and you look at Facebook to get the Facebook invite, but then instantly on the feed comes up something terrible, a beheading video of ISIS that you don't want to see. And then someone is then asking you something inane. And there's this sense where everything's bleeding together. The boundaries and the lines which separated stuff in the past are erasing. And so what causes this sense of dizziness, of vertigo, of confusion. What an airport is what Marc Auger, the French philosopher, calls a non-place. A place is somewhere where you're defined by a particular piece of land, a particular piece of soil, where you're defined by a set of kinship relationships where you're in that place. And you're someone because you're connected to those people. Some are blood relatives, other you're just connected to because you're there. You don't choose them, they're given to you. And then thirdly, a place where your identity is given to you. Soil, networks of relationships that are covenantal and lifelong and a given identity. An airport's the opposite. An airport is, you just need a passport, a boarding slip to go there. No one cares who you are. You can be in a suit, or you can be wearing shorts, or you can be wearing a mohawk. It's irrelevant, a hijab. It does not matter. Airports are really weird in that they're disconnected from a sense of place. Stores can be like this too. I bought the shirt I'm currently wearing at Uniqlo, and I can't remember exactly which Uniqlo it was. Was it the one in Melbourne at Chadstone? Was it the one where I went to in London? I went to one in New York speaking. And what's interesting is I remember the exchange with the cashier. I remember him. I can see him. He had dark hair. He was unshaven. He had a grey top on. It sort of had black on the sides. He was friendly. There was a problem with my card. I remember that exchange. He had an accent that was from Europe or something somewhere. But I don't know what country. I don't know where that was. It's placeless. It's disembodied. You have memories of something that occurred to you and someone you sent you a shocking text or something you saw online or that video on YouTube, and you probably cannot, with your synapses in your brain, remember what piece of soil that happened on because we're disembodied. And so a non-place is this place which is disconnected from history. It's disconnected from a sense of place. It's disconnected where you're not connected through covenantal relationships for life. You're connected through a sort of contractual, loosely held, commitment-phobic set of relationships. You don't get given identity. You choose and make an identity. So the graphic designer from the country in Australia who sits around with their conservative relatives who vote for the Conservative Party of Australia can move to a Melbourne, embed themselves in a little progressive utopia, surrounded by the like-minded, disconnected from what they were before. I constantly meet people who are still in the closet that they once went to church. A secret that I want to tell their progressive friends that I grew up Lutheran. Same can be like a Portland, where people can move here into a neighborhood which 50 years ago looked very different, which has been gentrified and changed, filled with people who then reinvent themselves and can be anything they want to be. Non-places, be they the gentrified hipster neighborhood, the airport, Uniqlo, the flat white in the cafe, give us little hints of how to fit in, but we're the ones in charge. We're the ones with autonomy. And so it felt like for a number of years that this was how the world was going to go, that it was going to head towards this progressive utopia where the world would eventually turn into a really laid-back coffee shop with friendly baristas. Islam, migration, all this stuff would be solved by just a bro hug and a free pour-over. But the reality is that underneath what we see as these non-religious, secular, progressive places moving away from religion, that there's actually a religious underbelly. There is a spiritual architecture. That actually there's these building blocks in place which are religious and we don't even understand why. We just operate. The scriptures tell us that eternity is in the hearts of humans. Augustine said that our hearts don't find rest until we find them in God. Pascal said that humans are born with a God-shaped hole. We humans are born for worship. Everything we do is worship. And so the elements of worship are in place for us as humans, even when we don't see them. I want to open the scriptures just to illustrate this. We're going to turn to Galatians 4, and we're going to look at verse 8. Galatians 4, verse 8. Paul's talking to the church in Galatia here, which is probably a particular area. This is an environment where it's in Turkey, but It's in a sense of globalization. It's a Greco-Roman city, just like there were Greco-Romans who lived according to this globalized culture of Greece and Rome, which you could have in Britain, you could have in North Africa, you could have in Asia Minor, you could have in Germany, in a place like Cologne. And these people lived this urban, sophisticated life in contrast to the pagani, the people who lived in the countryside, who they looked down on. But as the church begins to grow around the world, Jews and Gentiles coming together, as the political situation comes under more stress, particular temptations come for the church. And so Paul's writing to this church in Galatia, and a particular temptation is before them that in this moment of pressure is to actually return to older practices. Let's read. Verse 8. Formerly, when you did not know God, you were enslaved to those that by nature are not gods. A kind of slavery, a capturing has happened. But now that you've come to know God, or rather be known by God, how can you turn back to the weak and worthless elementary principles of the world, whose slaves you want to be once more? The key to understanding this verse is to understand what elementary principles are. If you look at the language, it refers to this word that was almost used like a building block of the universe. How people are wired to behave, that how our cultures come together. That for these guys, the temptation is to go away from the freedom of Christianity, which doesn't center itself around a temple and a Judaism that people are comfortable with. What it does is it offers this religion which is lived in homes. This personal relationship with Jesus. Judaism was this religion which had a sense of Jerusalem being the navel of the world, that at the center of Jerusalem was the temple. And the temple was this place which was pure. It was where God dwelt. It was his ambassador house. It was his emissary. It was his embassy in the world. And therefore, there was these different lines. So Gentiles who were God-fearers, who wanted to align themselves with the one true God of Israel, could only go so far. There was a place where there was a line which they couldn't cross. Jewish women could then just get to a particular part of the temple. There was another border for them. Jewish men could then enter, but who weren't part of the priesthood. And then there was this place which was the holiest of holies, where once a year the high priest or one of the guys chosen would go in there. They would tie a rope around his ankle so that if he wasn't truly purified and present himself as a sinless, spotless person before God, he could be overcome by the power of God, die, and they would pull him out. The temple existed to offer sacrifice for humanity, to atone for humanity's sins. So what you have is these three concepts: borders, purity of the sacred place, and sacrifice. And what's really interesting is Peter Lighthart picks up that there were people in this congregation who weren't just Jews. There was Gentile believers. And the Gentiles had their own temples as well. And they would offer sacrifice. When Rome, in the period of the early church, began to encounter defeats and the Roman order began to fall apart, Augustine, in his book, City of God, notes that the Romans began to turn on the Christians. They saw the Christians as the impure ones who had joined into the holy space of Rome and were being impure because they weren't offering the sacrifices to the gods and honoring the gods that needed to be honored. And so Paul's saying, don't fall into the temptation to fall back to these ways in which humanity has worshipped throughout history. That first verse, formerly when you did not know God, you were enslaved to those that by nature are not gods. He's saying these things don't have power. These things are not gods. Christ's death on the cross has changed all of this. When Christ died on the cross, the temple, the holiest of holies, the curtain separating the holiest of holies from the rest of the world, was ripped from top to bottom. The Spirit's now gone into the world. So what he's saying is, don't enslave yourself. Don't go back. So there's a second warning that he also has. And I want you to turn forward to Galatians 5, and we're going to look at verse 13. He's saying that, yes, there is the temptation for people to go backwards into the old ways of religion, what they formerly knew, but there's another temptation before people. For you were called to freedom, brothers. Verse 13, you were called to freedom, brothers. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. The falling back into the elemental principles was a falling back into the flesh. That was a fleshly way of worshiping. It was tangible. It was human striving. It was actually sacrificing the flesh of animals. Jesus kills the flesh on the cross. So there's this freedom. But Paul's saying there's another way that you could fall into flesh, and that's just to run towards freedom. And there was this temptation in the early church of cheap grace where people said Jesus died on the cross. Wow, we don't have to do that stuff anymore. We're just going to run into unlimited autonomy and freedom. Sin doesn't matter anymore. That's just sin like crazy. Let's do what the heck we want to do, and let's take Christianity in this direction where we just run beyond where Christ is. The kingdom of God without submission to the king. The elementary principles can also be another way of describing place. The security of soil. The sacred border of a national border. The sacrament of giving blood for the flag. This direction can be no place. The myth that humans just getting together through our own endeavor can create a kind of post-Christian, post-religious, progressive utopia, which takes all of the different grammar and language of the kingdom of God, of justice, of a bringing up of the poor, of including people, but does it through human steam. Utopia instead of the kingdom of God. Well, there's not really any need for a sacrifice where we naively imagine that all sin has gone, where we jump ahead in the story and jump out of this time, which is the time between Jesus' death and resurrection and his return, where N.T. Wright says it's like the end of World War II, when the decisive part of World War II was the Allied landing at Normandy. Like the game was up for Hitler and the Axis forces at that point, but there still was a time where they were still fighting towards Berlin. The forces of evil were still at play. We're in that zone. There was a time when Germany was completely defeated and Germany would be rehabilitated alongside Japan. And just there is a time where heaven and earth will be reunited and Christ will come and be king and the new Jerusalem will come down from the heavens and every tear will be wiped away and all evil will be thrown outside of the city and humans, the believers, will live in harmony with God, all the nations bringing their treasures before God. But we're not there right now. And we don't get there through better education, human niceness. And so, we find ourselves in a place between these two things. In between these two services. I just was checking the French presidential election, which has just announced the final two candidates for the May 7 final will be Monsieur Emmanuel Macron and Madame Marine Le Pen. Someone, Madame Le Pen, who wants to close the borders, which sees the evil as outside in migrants coming in, who wants to reclaim the sacrament of nationalism. Monsieur Macron wants to run with globalism, which wants to create this new international order based around inclusion, diversity. And we find ourselves now in a new environment where these two things are doing battle. It's no longer about left and right, as the Slovenian philosopher Žižek says. It's now between nationalism and globalism. This is worldwide. It's happening in my country. You have in Spain and Greece in recent years, parties on the further left. You have in Iceland the coming to power of the pirate party of hackers. You have in Poland a far-right government. You have in Hungary right-wing government. You've got in places like Burma and Sri Lanka the rising of anti-immigrant nationalist Buddhist monks, Hindu priests. What is happening in the world is that globalization smashes into place. And there's some of us which enjoy elements of that, but it offers us absolute freedom. Non-place offers us absolute freedom. Place offers meaning, and everyone's caught between the two at the moment. Something like that may have happened here. I'm not exactly sure. Did you have an election recently? I have not been following it. I just not on the news at all. And so, in a place like Melbourne or Portland, where do you stand? Where do you put yourself? What's actually happened in the last few years is the old left-right schism, Democrat, Republican, Labour, Conservative, it's been blown up. The Republican Party has actually been blown up. The Democrats will blow up. In Australia, the Greens Party is currently blowing up between hard left and those who want to work with corporations. And in this new landscape, this is a total culture war. This is no longer the culture war between people who are socially conservative and people who are progressive. This is something new. And it's only going to get more intense. What so many people in progressive cities like mine and yours don't realize is that migration leads to social conservatism. The myth is the more people of color, the more immigrants, the more people from Bangladesh, they're just going to turn into progressive hipsters as soon as they get here. It doesn't work like that. And so my big repentance before God is that my ministry for 10, 15 years has been presuming that everyone's to the cultural left of me. That everyone I'm going to talk to is going to be some sort of postmodern relativist progressive person. Increasingly, when I talk to people outside my circle, when I talk to my Chinese hairdresser, when I talk to working class people, when I talk to relatives who haven't benefited from the absolute freedom and ability to just sit in a coffee shop, they're hurting. They feel their sense of place going. And so the church finds itself between these two places, and there is a temptation. There was a temptation in this country for some time to align Christianity with just a particular conservative view of politics. But now the new reality is that you have temptations on both sides. There is a temptation to fall back into the elemental principles of the world, to re-embrace a kind of Christendom, to be repelled by the continual leftward drag of the new progressivism, and to find a sense of security, a return to place, to put up the borders. Others of us find temptation in the progressive to always be feeling out of step. That horrible moment when perhaps you're with your friends and everything's good and it's a sunny afternoon. Actually, that doesn't translate here at all, does it? There was one when I was here. I did see it with my own eyes. Was it yesterday? And you're at a pub, you're at a cafe, and everything's peachy, and then something about sexual ethics comes up. and that constant pressure. What are you doing on Sunday? I might like go for a ride, and I might go for a hike, and I'm going to get brunch. I go to church. Sorry, you're going to what? I'm going to go to church. What on earth are you? And that constant pressure. And so there's this element, like maybe that constant pressure when you get on Facebook and maybe you see what your uncle just put up and you're like, I'm just not down with that. That's just crazy. That's this temptation. He hasn't just fallen into the elemental principles. He's built a survivalist hut out of them. And he's fully armed. So you find yourself drifting this way. I want to say that we're going to find ourselves in an increasingly uncomfortable position. I want to say that that's not Christianity, and that's not Christianity. That Paul's words to the church in Galatia are his words that ring true today. The church is meant to be in a different position. We cannot fall back to a sacrificial system where we look at the outsider and go, all the sin of the world is outside. It's that person from the Middle East, or it's that person who is, you know, different to us. We can't put up the walls because, as Solzhenitsyn said, evil is not in that group of people. It runs through the human heart. And evil is in here. This temptation as well does the same thing. It tries to create, actually put up its own walls. We create our own gentrified hipster utopias. And it's not the illegal immigrants, but it's the stupid rednecks. We demonize the working class. We don't understand what it's like when someone is knocking at your door to take your car away and you've obeyed every rule and done all the right stuff and then the world in 5 years has just changed and now you're a freaking bigot, according to the media. And the sin for us, we can get all virtuous signal and go, our church, we embrace refugees or whatever. But then we talk smack about the working poor who are hurting. And so both sides end up putting barriers. Marine Le Pen is running on a platform just like Geert Wilders just did in the Dutch election, which is actually phase two of progressivism, where after a while, when you start to get a number of migrants, particularly migrants from immigrant countries like Islamic countries, they're socially conservative. They're often homophobic. So Marine Le Pen says, if you like gay rights, if you like liberal France, if you like progressive France, we need to keep those people out. This is what Geert Wilders says. So the world is erecting barriers and the church stands in the middle in this place. And so who we are is exactly who the church was in the early first century. It's this place which doesn't find itself in a temple. It cannot grab onto identity in the ways that the world did. The Roman centurion, battle-hardened, sold out to the Roman vision of Pax Romana, a man who people respect, broad-chested, martial, then would have to sit down in a church next to a slave girl, someone with no power, and then hear this epistle from the Apostle Paul, which says, there is no longer Jew or Gentile, male or female, Greek or barbarian. And these gatherings in these homes, in apartment complexes of these people who then had to lay down all their pretensions to power, who kneeled not at the foot of Caesar or even rebels outside the city who wanted to fight the Roman order, but instead laid their authority at the foot of Christ. Now, there's a temptation with that to hear like there's no longer male or female, no longer this stuff, to not then run into absolute freedom and to do it with their own steam. But who understood that God has allowed restraints in the world. His creational order still exists. So holding this position of freedom, but restraint which gives meaning, that is a creative tension which is really hard to hold. But you're called to hold it. And we hold it not through our own strength. The language that the church used in that context is a different battle, not between place, non-place, not between freedom and meaning, not between borders and borderlessness, but between flesh and spirit. That A fall back into the elemental principles is a fall into flesh. A fall into the freedom to run towards a progressive utopia is a fall into flesh. Instead, we are to die to the flesh. Every limitation that you face is a chance for your flesh to die. Every suffering is a chance for your flesh to die. Nassim Nicholas Taleb talks in his book, Anti-Fragile, that at this moment where we can't predict what's happening in the world's chaotic, that everything's becoming fragile. Companies can fall over a public relations disaster. Look at United last week with that guy getting dragged off the plane. Like, one thing like that can happen. Someone can film it and everything's becoming fragile. We have the anxiety epidemic means the individual who's been told they live in a world of unending freedom and no borders is becoming a fragile person. Epidemics of chronic fatigue, epidemics of depression, epidemics of people just losing themselves in drink and drugs. Taleb says that we need to become anti-fragile. We need to allow the shocks to make us better. As I read his book, I'm like, what's the Christian version of that? And then I thought of Paul in 2 Corinthians. I was shipwrecked. I was whipped. When I am weak, his strength is made perfect in my weakness. When you are uncomfortable and you're sitting there going, oh my goodness, I'm just about to be outed as a social freak here in Portland. It's your flesh dying. Christ has potential for his strength to live in you at that moment. When you guys as a church try and do justice and see elements of welcoming the outsider, practicing biblical hospitality alongside then holding on to the gospel and the fact that we live according to the creational mandate and that our sexual ethics are going to be different, that we don't actually fit into the stupid binary towers that everything's thrown into, you're going to feel uncomfortable. But that's exactly where God wants you to be. I want to end with the story of how Australia and America are linked. America has the War of Independence, which goes to creating this incredible country. It really is. It's this starting of what becomes the most powerful country in the history of the world. The backstory to that is that Britain was in this giant change where people were moving to the cities, globalization was happening, technological advance, and people who were the urban underclass flooded into the cities. The Enlightenment was beginning, and this idea of social engineering. Before then, there was this vision which people would live in parishes and they would care in this particular place. Then people move into these places, and what they do is they start getting rid of the urban underclass. Many of them were sent here as indentured workers. They would fill rotting hulks with this scum of the British Empire. When the War of Independence happens, Britain has nowhere to send these people. They think creatively, and they just discovered this land at the bottom of the world. It's going to Mars. And this is a place to remove this impoverished class of people and the mistaken belief that they could rehabilitate them by putting them down under. This is where my story begins. My great, 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 great grandmother, a poor Welsh servant girl who became pregnant. We don't know if she was raped. We don't know if, like, the master of the house she was serving at got her pregnant. We don't know, but she took her baby and threw it in the river. She's sentenced to go to literally hell on earth at Port Arthur in Tasmania. I've been there. It's an incredibly dark place. I went to the registry where I look up my relative's name. The prison there was built through Jeremy Bentham, the utilitarian philosopher's idea that we could rehabilitate people by creating this machine of a prison. The guards wore Hessian shoes so that no one would hear their feet, so the prisoners would not hear another human being. The prisoners were giving numbers, not names. The ones that got there, who survived being on their ships in chains across the world. William Wilberforce and the Clapham sect in Britain of evangelicals tried to speak into this and saying this is actually a form of slavery. They didn't want to see this because of the racial overtones of what that then would mean. This was called a post-Christian society. Australia was called a post-Christian society in the 18th century. Convicts, prostitutes, and soldiers being punished by the British Empire. The missionaries come, and they come to Australia, and they don't know what to do, just as they did not know what to do as the world was changing when they went to America, when they went to South Africa, when they went to the Caribbean, New Zealand, Australia, because the parish system of what was the church's place would be clearly set since the Dark Ages to this period, and you had a church in the middle. And then you would have people come to that church and everyone had their name registered. You got christened there and you got baptized there and you had your wedding there. But all of a sudden that system of where the church fitted had completely disappeared. And so what you have is these guys who then come to these new situations, giving the gospel to African-American slaves, going to places like Jamaica and sharing it with slaves there, going to South Africa and going across cultural lines to the indigenous people of this country. On the frontiers of the West, these Christians who found themselves in an incredibly complex, uncomfortable situation. But out of that complexity, that moment when actually some of the predictions was in the 18th century that the church would disappear. That was again said in the 19th century. Auguste Comte, the French atheist philosopher, said that by the year 1900, Sacré-Cœur in France, the cathedral will be a rationalist temple and Christianity will have died. But what happens is these women, these men in these uncomfortable situations then are forced to think creatively. At Port Arthur, the prison where my relative Elizabeth Brooks was, there was a Methodist preacher. He got there and he didn't know where his parish was anymore. That's what he was used to, the idea of a parish. And he prayed and prayed and he felt God saying to him, your parish is the 30 steps between the holding cell for the prisoners on death row and the gallows. He would walk those 30 steps with these men and women who are about to lose their lives in a barbaric machine prison at the end of the world, to share the gospel. Some, as the noose went around their neck, would receive the gift of tongues. We are in a situation, we don't know our parishes anymore. But we face the opportunity to reinvent what it is to be this church in this time. Not reinvent it and come up with some newfangled theology, not to come up with newfangled methodology, but to, in this moment of complexity and chaos and cultural pressure, to embrace that, because that is when the church is always at her best. You are created by God for this moment. You are here in Portland at this moment because of divine providence. You were not called here to put your head down. You're not called here to hide away. You're not called here to drift into the progressive utopias, to run into the freedom. You're not called to be repelled into the elementary principles. You're called to stand in the middle where the church has always been, the point of creative tension. And allow your flesh to die. Allow the spirit to move. To be allowed to actually go, you know what? Over cities like Portland and like Melbourne, if that first verse that we read in Galatians 4 is right, that which is not of God, that is those things that worshipping that are not of God, that they're actually, in a sense, a gods over our city. mythologies, that you're called to pray against them. Pray for redemption. Cry out for our cities. You are created for this moment. Let's become anti-fragile. Let's get better as the pressure gets higher. You were created for this moment. And my prayer is, as I've been in Portland, God's doing some stuff here. This is the bleeding edge. If large parts of the world will head in this direction, God will want to do something in a place like this. Let me pray for you.